We are lucky enough to live, work, and record this podcast on the land of the Kaurna people. We acknowledge their ongoing connection to sea country and the importance of Indigenous knowledge in caring for the ocean. Welcome to The Ocean Pod, a podcast about all things to do with marine science and the ocean. You are joined by myself, Dr. Nina Wootton, and my co-host, Professor Bronwyn Galanders. We are both marine scientists from the University of Adelaide with a huge passion for all things ocean. Hi, Bronwyn.
Hi, Nina. In this episode of Ocean Pod, we're diving deep into the icy waters of the Arctic to talk about one of the most extraordinary whales on Earth, the bowhead whale. We're joined by Nick Freimuller, a paleoecologist and biogeographer whose research explores how species respond to climate change, past, present and future. But first, it's time for Tide Talk. Nina, what caught your attention this week?
Well, I think it would be amiss of me to not mention my field trip that I've just come back from. So I've just been away for 3 weeks up in the Northern Territory again, doing the Toys for Turtles project that we have spoken about previously on the podcast, working with the rangers recycling plastics and doing beach cleans and lots of school outreach. But this trip, it was my favourite trip yet because I got to spend almost a week fishing. Just going off, we went on a charter and then we made friends with a local fisher there who took us out fishing as well. I caught so many fish.
And so what was your favourite species that you caught?
Oh, that's a good question, actually. As I'm now going back and having to ID all the fish, I'm starting to realise that I actually don't love all the species as much as I thought I did when I first caught them. I did catch one, this really big fish called a painted sweet lips, and it was like the biggest fish I've ever caught. It was really heavy. It was nearly 4 kilos.
Wow.
And that was probably my favourite species, but we only caught one of them, so it's not very good for our replication data. But we did keep it, and we took the otoliths out, the ear bones, and also took the gut contents and some sample of flesh for looking at microplastics and heavy metals, which is what we were doing with that. It was so fun.
Nina might be the reason that the building smells so bad at the moment.
Yeah, it smells really fishy.
Yes,
me
it does.
Me and my interns, we're
it
all working on our...
It smells very fishy.
Our building always smells fishy, Bronwyn. Mm-hmm. It's made me have a new passion, I think, for fishing. Because I've never really been a fisher.
Because you could catch so many at once. Yeah, I'm not very good at just sitting there and waiting and waiting and waiting.
I thought the same. Like, I'm very impatient, as a lot of people that know me will know. So I thought I would get really bored. But because it's the NT and there's so many fish, and we were on a great charter who helped us make sure that we were catching a lot. Honestly, if it was more than a minute, I would pull up and be like, oh, the bait's gone. Like, it was literally, like, there were so many fish. They were just biting at it everywhere. In the first half an hour, we caught like 25 fish.
Wow, that's incredible.
Lot. Yeah, it was really exciting. So, you know, good for the low attention span people like myself. But it was a great field trip, had a great time. Sad to be back, but we're coming into spring now, so the weather's looking a bit better down here, which is good.
Yeah, we're meant to have some hot weather.
Yes, finally. Anyway, that's my tide talk. What about you, Bronwyn? What's your tide
talk
for the week?
Mine's not quite as exciting as yours, but we got a paper out recently that's looking at shell banding in a cockle and then seeing whether the banding correlates with trace element concentrations.
Oh, yeah.
And so the idea is that, like, that you can't necessarily age species really easily with the growth increments that form within them. And so would these trace element profiles across, like, shells in this case, but you can do it for otoliths, would they help? And so there's some really cool work that people in my lab group did, working with New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, to have a look at that and evaluate the potential suitability for age estimation. And so it looks like it aligns really nicely. So that means if you've got cockles that don't have really good growth increments in them, potentially you can use magnesium concentrations to age them.
Oh, Oh, so different. And are other elements also usable, or just magnesium?
Well, magnesium was one of the better ones. They also were using strontium as well. So it's magnesium calcium ratios. They're also looking at strontium calcium. And then they've used some quite innovative peak detection algorithms to pick up the peaks to help match up. So, yeah, pretty cool.
Today, we're heading north to the Arctic to talk about one of the most extraordinary whales on Earth, the bowhead whale. We're joined by Nick Freimuller, a paleoecologist and biogeographer who studies fossils, extinctions, and how species respond to climate change throughout Earth's history.
Nick has recently completed his PhD between the University of Copenhagen and the University of Adelaide. He uses ecological modelling and paleo records to understand how species adapt or don't adapt when their environments change. We'll be chatting about bowhead whales, the Arctic, and what the past can teach us about the future of our oceans. Hi, Nick. It's great to have you today.
Great to be here and be with both of you today.
Yay. Great to have you as well. So before we dive in, this is actually a question maybe slightly for me, but also for our listeners. Paleoecology and biogeography might be new words for some people. Can you explain what they mean and what you actually study as a paleoecologist and biogeographer?
Yeah, so I would say what I'm most interested in studying and what I spend most of my time on is extinction. I've always been fascinated by extinction. How do extinctions happen? Why do certain extinctions happen if we're talking about mechanisms? And what happens after a whole bunch of species go extinct at one point in time? And some of these rise to this level of mass extinctions when you have these massive die-offs and most of the tree of life on Earth just gets completely shredded. I think this is relevant because we're currently entering the sixth of these mass extinctions in Earth's history. And because the way that I think about this is that these two fields of paleoecology and biogeography, they actually help answer stuff about extinction. So paleoecology is how do ecosystems work in the past? How do different species interact with each other in the past? How do these systems change over time in response to things like climate change or human activity, anthropogenic disturbances? Biogeography is simply the question of why do species live where they do and why do they not live where they don't? But a lot of research into that, it essentially is how do species respond to climate change? And for example, many Australian species used to be much more widespread across the continent prior to European arrival, but now they are only exist in these small isolated pockets that are fragments of their former distribution. And so these two fields might sound quite different, but they're actually quite complementary when it comes to learning about extinction, why, how, and what the heck happens to ecosystems after all these extinctions happen. Mm-hmm. And it's because we often think of extinction as like a one event in time. Mm-hmm. It's some point when maybe the last individual dies, or maybe the last population gets super isolated, or the last female or male of the species dies. But it's extinction is much better thought of as a process. It's a pathway that species can be set on. That pathway often begins long, long before the species ever becomes endangered or threatened, in some cases thousands of years. And often in order to be extinct, you first have to become rare. And the processes that cause species to become rare and endangered in the first place might be radically different from what causes the last final few populations to disappear as well. So that's a rough background of what I'm really interested in and why these two disparately sounding fields actually complement each other really nicely.
And then for your PhD, you've obviously been applying this to whales. So how did you get into loving whales? Do you love the ocean? Did you grow up spending time around a marine environment, or has this passion come from somewhere else?
Yeah, so I kind of stumbled into this PhD by accident. So I'm originally from Fairbanks, Alaska, which is in the middle of Alaska. So I was, you know, had passion about growing up in the Arctic in general, but we were pretty far from the ocean. I did get a little bit of research, marine research, during my undergraduate work because I did my bachelor's and my master's degree in New Mexico, which is American Southwest, very far from the land, though, working on extinction of Cretaceous mollusks, at least. But I actually got this opportunity to study Arctic marine mammals in general through this joint PhD. That's just how it was advertised. And it was using some of the techniques that I was interested in, some of the methods. And, you know, growing up, even not being surrounded by all these species, but just knowing that they're you know, the nearest coastline away, it picked up a really interesting opportunity for me to jump at. And of course, it got me out of the US, which is desirable nowadays, I would say.
I feel like that's actually an interesting response, because we often interview marine scientists, and you're probably a little bit outside of that realm, but although you do study a marine mm-hmm. animal, which is what we're here to listen about. But I think that, yeah, it's funny because everyone we speak to is like, yeah, I grew up loving the ocean, and you were inland.
It's an accident for me. Like,
no, that's good though. You obviously enjoy it.
Yeah.
So you spoke a bit then about your joint PhD between Copenhagen and Adelaide. That's pretty cool. Pretty unique, I would say. Can you share what it's like to balance these two worlds, and how has that kind of helped you shape your research as well, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, the PhD is, it sounds complex. Like, how do you do a PhD, not just at two universities, but in two countries on two continents? But in the day-to-day doesn't change much. You start your PhD in one country, move to Denmark during COVID, which was awkward. But then a year in, I just moved to Australia. So the day-to-day doesn't actually change much. It's just the bureaucracy that's a bit annoying. But I'd say how each has sort of enhanced my research. So I'm mainly an ecologist, paleoecologist by training, but the lab that I work with in Copenhagen, they do a lot of work with ancient DNA and paleogenetics. And so that was, as the token ecologist in that lab, it was really interesting to be in an environment where I knew very little, but I just tried to be a sponge and was able to absorb all sorts of information about that. And then here, Australia, I mainly work in mammals, but Australia is ground zero for mammal extinctions. The extinction rate of mammals here is higher than anywhere else in the world. And I wanted to hone these ecological modeling skills and these methods that I've been developing over the last couple of years. And if I want to understand extinction, Australia is the place to do it here. And my advisory team is fortunately been quite chill this whole time, so, which is always good. You never want to have a bad advisor.
So you start, yeah, of course not. Not luckily Bronwyn's the best. So. So did you start living in Copenhagen and then you just decided to move here because you wanted to?
Yeah, so it was just the PhD was advertised, you will spend at least one year in Copenhagen and then between, you know, a year and a half and 2 years down in Adelaide.
Oh, so it was already kind of structured.
Was how it was advertised from the beginning.
That's cool.
I think they're all structured like that, the Uni Adelaide, Uni Copenhagen ones, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah. It used to be that it was advertised, okay, you'll spend the first year in Australia, then move to Denmark for the second year, and then move back here for the third year, and then no one applied for that because why would
That's
you have
hard.
Any connectivity? And yeah. Especially if you're a you know, in your 20s and a starving graduate student. Oh, I have to move countries all the time. That sounds expensive. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So let's come to the bowhead whales. Mm-hmm. They're pretty remarkable animals. And for listeners that might not know much about them, what makes these Arctic giants so special?
So I'm sure as you're aware, and many of your listeners are aware, there's two sort of big types of whales. There's the toothed whales like orcas and dolphins and baleen whales. Bowheads are in this latter category. They're the only baleen whale that's endemic to the Arctic. They spend their entire year round there. They're one of the longest lived mammals of all time. Individuals can live over 200 years of age. So this is just a remarkably long lived animal. They're of immense cultural significance for Inuit peoples across the Arctic who rely on them for subsistence food sources. They hunt them and whale them. And I think it's something like one third of the diet of the nutrients that Inuit consume throughout the year are due to bowhead whales. And wow. They're of immense cultural significance as well. And so and because they're megafauna, I love me a megafaunal species. They have this outsized impact on ecosystem function just because they eat krill, so they these clouds of krill that they just gulp with their massive mouths throughout the Arctic, they basically have a direct link to controlling what is almost de facto the base of the food web in the Arctic, because these krill, you know, support the small fish populations that support the large fish and the seals and the polar bears and everything. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you have such a large bodied species directly controlling what is effectively the base of the food web is really remarkable, such that if anything happens to bowheads, you might then have cascading effects that, you know, may progress and reverberate throughout the rest of the ecosystem.
That's pretty cool. But so they don't do the large migrations like you might see for humphead whales and southern right whales and things. They're pretty much just in the Arctic.
So they migrate within the Arctic. It also depends on what part of the Arctic you're in. So I'll say there's four main management units or populations of bowhead whales. There's the ones in East Greenland. There's ones in Canada, West Greenland. There's ones off the coast of Alaska. And then in the Sea of Okhotsk in Russia, west of Kamchatka. depending on which population you look at, some of them, they do seasonal migration, but it's all within the Arctic. They never actually leave. And with other ones, particularly in East Greenland and the Sea of Okhotsk, they don't actually do migration in the traditional sense. They have a large range in the Arctic, but they can show up at any part of that range at any time throughout the year. And it might be that this is because those two populations are still reeling from the effects of commercial whaling. They're at really small population sizes, maybe only 300 or 400 individuals there.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's so... So this is maybe a silly question, but I always say there's never a silly question.
Yes.
So it's obviously the Arctic and it's icy.
It's very icy,
very
as
cold.
Well. Yes.
So they're living like under the ice and out?
Yeah, so they live near the ice margin. There's other species like beluga and especially narwhal, which are much more in the deep ice, and they really only come up for breathing, and they will dive. But bowheads are on the sea ice edge, if you will.
Okay.
And they sort of track this area, and there's different hypotheses about why that might happen. Theoretically, if they live in more open oceans with less ice, there's more sunlight that can permeate through the water, and that might enable more photosynthesis, more primary productivity, more food sources. But potentially you're also exposing yourselves to competition from other whales, which sometimes migrate into the Arctic during the summer, and predation risk by killer whales, potentially. Depends on who you ask. There's a lot of very passionate views about this.
All right, that makes sense. Now I know where they live. It's interesting. So your work has focused a fair bit on extinction and ecological responses. What can bowhead whales teach us about survival and adaptation during major climate changes?
So yeah, we in some of my research has found they're quite resilient to past climate change. And part of this is aided by the fact that they have really these really long generation times. They probably are able to start reproducing at about maybe 20, 30, 25, 30 years. They'll keep growing until they're roughly 50, and then they might just continue living till 200 years. And there's no evidence that we know of them being post-reproductive. They might still be able to reproduce up until 200 years old, potentially. And so that has this ability that if there's, you know, a short period of time where maybe every individual in some hypothetical scenario where every individual of one generation gets completely wiped out, you might still have older individuals who are still able to then potentially repopulate the population and help it grow back up. And so this long generation time is potentially a key to how they've been so resilient over past periods of even remarkable and intense climate change.
Wow. So how often do they breed then?
I don't remember the exact specifics, but it's every couple years. I think it's about 5-year interbirth intervals for the females, at least.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with the males. Theoretically, they can sire many offspring whenever, yeah, as most males can. But it's roughly 5 years in between, for 4 or 5 years in between births for females. Or it might be two. My work deals with less of the reproductive biology, mm-hmm, and more the long-term response to climate, mm-hmm, change, but...
That's interesting. I feel like that is, if you could have a baby at 200 years old, that is crazy, in my opinion. So is there evidence of that?
Yeah, so there's, I think the longest individual, there's fancy ways they can tell some of the age of these whales. Like the obvious, the easiest to understand one is, I think the most recent example of this was in 2007. Off the coast of Alaska, the Inuit peoples in a village had harvested a bowhead whale that still had a harpoon embedded in it from the whaling period. And because the technology evolved so rapidly and whalers were always wanting to use the most up-to-date killing weaponry, they were able to determine that this was manufactured between like a 6-year period in the 1870s. And it would have probably been used very soon afterwards as well. And so that at least says, okay, they can get up to at least 150 years old. But there's other individuals that using some other molecular dating techniques, using amino acids, that it's very likely that some individuals are over 200 years old, potentially reaching 250.
Wow.
Part of the reason we don't know about this is because their populations were just so devastated by whaling, and their population size might have been reduced 90%. So we just don't actually know, because there might, yeah, not even be... there could be individuals that could maybe live as long as the Greenland shark, live 400 years or plus. It's just that we've killed them all in the past. So yeah, it's hard to know.
So then you were applying some of these ecological modelling skills to like fossils to understand past ecosystems. How do these tools actually help us reconstruct ancient environments and species responses?
Yeah, so we don't actually know how species, we know how we can observe today, we can go out and observe species and see how they're responding to climate change, but that's only, say, 50 years, which sounds like a long time, but these are individuals that can live over 200. So we have no idea about how multiple, how climate change may affect multiple generations of whales as well. And so a lot of the other challenges is that you can have a fossil of some other species, of any species that's thousands and thousands of years old, that might be well outside the distribution of where the species currently lives. So there's bowhead whale fossils that are 13,000 years old from Denmark now, even though they don't get anywhere close to Denmark today. And that's interesting, but it doesn't actually tell you about how that translates to conservation. So there's different sort of units that you're working with. There's different currency almost. And so this ecological modeling approach is, they allow you to translate, you know, the inference into the same units, into the same currency. So we're not comparing apples to horses, for example. Mm-hmm. And that, and from that, you can then understand, here's where they've been, just here's where the whales have been over the last several thousand years. Here's how they've responded to past climate change. And that can give you this long-term baseline to how they will respond to future change. Mm-hmm. The past is the key to the present. Mm-hmm. Or as Shakespeare said in The Tempest, what's past is prologue.
So you have sort of touched on this briefly, but the Arctic is obviously changing incredibly fast at the moment. How do the past climate shifts that you've been studying compare to what is currently happening in the region?
Yeah, so at least currently today, the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the globe on average. It's one of the fast, the Arctic and also the Antarctic as well, it's the fastest warming part of the planet. And what we've, my research has found is we focused on the last almost 12,000 years of bowhead whale persistence throughout the Arctic during a period called the Holocene. There is known climate fluctuations throughout there, and bowheads have been remarkably fine with that, but future warming is just on a completely different level.
Yeah, it's a different scale, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So there are previous periods of past warming, such as when you come out of the last glacial period, or what people call the Ice Age. We didn't have as much data going further back there. We didn't have as much fossil data, so we were able... I wanted to focus on when the last roughly 12,000 years, when there's a lot of data, and I can trust the quality of that data. Mm-hmm. So if we had looked further back, we might have found some other interesting patterns to see. Well, they might have responded to past extreme climate fluctuations quite fine, but at least in terms of current warming, it's by far excessive to anything they've experienced in the last 11,700 years.
Okay, so it's still an unknown, I guess.
Yes.
So you're obviously dealing with fossils and you're dealing with data modeling. Mm-hmm. So what does a typical day in your life of research actually look like?
It's you're hyping me up too much. It's not as sexy as a lot of people would imagine. You know, I don't actually do much lab work or field work. So most of my work is just sitting at a computer, working with databases, cleaning data, and working in debugging code, which to most people sounds quite dry. But I really like this. It's almost like I'm a forensic detective aspect of this. And being able to find these hidden patterns in the big data that no one else can find. And from that, you can understand these biological processes. I kind of liken it to being lost in a desert, and yet you have the ability to squeeze water out of a rock. Mm-hmm. And it's just this ability that you can unearth these you know, hidden patterns that biology and life on Earth has left and spattered throughout the fossil record, and to be able to take all of these things together and combine them and produce something that's much greater than the sum of its parts. That sort of forensic aspect of that is really interesting. I always wanted to be a paleontologist when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's cool.
I wanted to be Alan Grant and dig up dinosaur bones, but my research is much closer to Ian Malcolm and computer modeling as well.
I love it. I love that analogy to like the forensic side of things and like detective sort of work.
Yeah, it's very cool. So you spend a lot of time at a computer though?
Most of my day is at a computer and cursing out the archaeologist and anthropologist who can't report data very cleanly, which I'm sure a lot of us have in science have frustrating experiences.
I feel like we all spend more time at a computer than we wish we were, but yours sounds like it's very desktop-based.
It is mostly desktop-based. I was hoping to be able to do some work with stable isotopes, which can tell you about the dietary ecology of some of these species, and this is stuff I might have a chance to move into in the next year and do a bit more lab work, but as for the past couple of years and the next year or so, it's going to continue to be mostly based at a computer.
Yeah, we do stable isotope stuff in our group. So. Mm-hmm. What's something that you found really surprising or exciting about bowhead whales, or I guess your research in general, What would be your biggest kind of find that you would say excited you?
Yeah, so we can discuss, I think one of the cool things, this is a paper that we've submitted for publication. It's currently available as a preprint right now, so it hasn't gone through the full peer review process, but we're pretty confident in our answers. So I mentioned earlier how there's four management stocks, like fisheries, as you will, of bowhead whales throughout the Arctic. What we found is that there's only three genetic populations, and we found that the Alaskan and Canadian populations, which were thought to be completely separate from each other, are actually form one genetically indistinguishable population. And so that was something that, moving forward, we think that longer term conservation should sort of accommodate that and change the conservation of this species. Another thing that this is another paper that's currently in review now. I can't go into too much detail, but because this was the first whale species that humans crossed oceans to commercially exploit, and from this their population size decreased by about 90%. And there's some recovery, but it's only in this Alaskan and Canadian population that are recovering. The East Greenland population and Sea of Okhotsk are not. And so there's this really unclear asymmetry. Why are only two populations recovering? And this also has applications to other whales as well. Some other research that I did that I can only tease, it was about whaling, but we've likely been able to explain why these two populations are actually recovering so much, because these lessons might be applicable to other whale species that are either recovering or are not. Because bowheads were the first species to be exploited, and they're only starting to recover now, other species that were still harvested much later into the 20th century, and even some are still exploited today, what happens to bowheads is a good indicator of what might happen to other whale species as well.
Yeah, they're a good starting point, definitely.
Exactly.
And I'm sure once you publish it, we'll see a lot of media out
there. Oh, there will be a lot of media if the peer reviewers actually like this. So we're pretty bullish on this.
Yeah.
I don't want to tease it too much, but I'll let it go through the peer review process.
Wait, so they're still whaling, I think you said this at the start. Are they still whaling actively there now?
Yeah, so it's really weird. So there is Inuit subsistence whaling across the Arctic as well. But also, ironically, the two populations, the Alaskan and Canadian management stocks, those are the two that have recovered the most since whaling. But ironically, those are the two where there also has been indigenous subsistence whaling. So, right. I mean, offtake is offtake on some level, but it's pretty clear that the Inuit are not the reason that this species is endangered or threatened as well.
No.
Like even still, despite the low level of subsistence offtake, those populations have still managed to recover as well.
Mm.
But yeah, there's no commercial whaling of bowheads anymore. That was abandoned by about 1914. Too many vessels, you know, went up to the Arctic to try and exploit them, but they came back empty-handed. And so a lot of them then pivoted to Australia or Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, and you know, the whales there, even though they were less profitable than bowheads, there were more of them, and it was easier to exploit as well.
Mm-hmm.
The actual conservation, the first sort of conservation initiatives on bowheads were signed 20 years after people had already abandoned the species for economic purposes.
Okay.
And I think it's one of the only species where that's the case as well.
Wow.
So
for aging these whales, I think they've used earwax of some species for aging. Have they tried that with bowhead whales wanting to kill any?
Yeah, I don't remember it depends on also the age of the individual. So I know that in your lab, you do a lot of work with otoliths, with the inner ear bones, and basically it leaves annual growth rings, much like a tree does, and you can count that. In whales, that only works up to about 30 years, because then the layers get so thin, you can't actually tell the difference between them. So as I mentioned earlier, you can use, if you found a whale that you know when the death was, and it has this old whaling harpoon in that, you can date that to a precise period. The oldest whales that they found, the ones that say this is probably over 200 years, use this technique called amino acid dating. It's a little bit, might be quite complex, but it's, you can actually use it to date the age of the individual. And they use, what is it? I think it's the amino acid isoleucine from the nucleus of the eye, because that forms when you're in utero before you're born. And it does, unlike your blood or your other tissues, it doesn't get remade over the course of your lifetime. So when it formed is when it was actively, it had, you know, all the isoleucine it will ever have go into it. And then you can use some fancy dating metrics to say, okay, here's the uncertainty based on how much isoleucine has changed and rationalized over the years. So
very cool.
It's about as simple as I can get it, but
no, you did a good job.
So one of the things that you've been working on is this amazing open access database of fossil Arctic marine mammals, and that pulls together everything from radiocarbon ages through to ancient DNA. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, and so a lot of this is a big paper that we spent nearly four years working on, and it finally came out last month, and people will say, oh, what's the importance of databases? Why are these important? But for someone like me who does a lot of ecological modeling, good models require good data. If you put garbage in, you get garbage out. And one of the things that I've been trying to harp on more over the past several years has been to try and get a really holistic understanding of the species, not just looking at, oh, this simple aspect of ecology, but to try and analyze how they might respond to climate change in multiple ways. And so this paper brought together information from radiocarbon, so we know how old the individual is, stable isotopes, which again tell about the dietary preferences, and ancient DNA, so we can understand from multiple angles how these species respond over time. So this database includes bowheads, narwhal, beluga, polar bear, walrus, half a dozen seal species, and one extinct sea cow that was used to be up near the Arctic as well, up until the 1700s. Mm-hmm. So it was just a massive database that I wanted to try and, you know, put together such that we now have a really good basis for which I at least can start running all of these fancy ecological models and pull more water out of those rocks at least. So
cool. Yeah, and you have a paper from that too, so I'll link that in the show notes if people are interested in seeing that. So obviously you've been involved in some pretty cool projects, and across the board I want to talk a little bit more actually maybe about this polar bear thing.
Can
you tell me a little bit about the polar bear work that you're planning on doing?
Yeah, I think part of the understanding is to use these sort of paleo archives to understand how polar bears have responded to climate change over thousands of years, very similar to what we're doing for the bowheads at least. This is sort of a not quite very set in stone in terms of what we'll actually do, but that's sort of it was what I wanted to do at the start of the PhD, but because there was so much data on the bowheads from this extensive fossil record to all of these old whaling logbooks that I looked through and trying to understand that, it just made sense to focus on the polar bears or on the bowheads for now. But one of the things I want to try and do with the polar bears is see if I can, there's this current, people think now that, oh, there were 6,000 polar bears in the 1960s. This is the statistic that you often see thrown out, but there's maybe 24 or 30,000 now. And people, you know, assume that, this might mean that polar bears are actually recovering and not actually that threatened by climate change. And one of the things that I want to do is actually challenge this understanding that there was 6,000 polar bears in the 60s. There was probably a lot more, and having gone through some of these sources, it's very clear that this 6,000 number is a massive underestimate, but that's the general idea. So.
Oh, cool. It's exciting. Mm.
So finally, for our young people out there that might listen and love the idea of studying the past to understand the future, what advice would you give somebody that's going to build a career in paleoecology or marine science?
So I would say find something that you're interested in. I mean, I was always growing up, I was always interested in extinction. How do extinctions happen? I was fortunate to live in an area where there was all these Ice Age megafauna fossils, all these woolly mammoths and stuff just around. There's a wealth of that in Alaska. So find something that you're interested in and find a skill set that you might be able to work towards analyzing this with. I've settled on ecological modeling. Other folks have settled on stable isotopes or ancient DNA. But there's a lot of really interesting interdisciplinary techniques that we can start to use to get a more holistic purpose. Again, it's this like forensic aspect of it that I just find fascinating. So pick something that you're interested in, find a skill set you can analyze it with, and maybe I would say brush up a little bit more on your coding skills, because that's an increasingly in demand skill set. So I don't want to tell everyone learn to code, but it's increasingly becoming a requirement in this day and age, especially for more earlier career scientists.
Yeah, it is. So thank you so much, Nick. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for joining us on Ocean Pod. I've learned a lot about bowhead whales and also fossils and climate change, and I know our listeners would have really enjoyed that as well. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Nina and Bronwyn.
It's always good to see what people actually do, because I run into Nick always around the corridors, and I think, I know you work on bowhead whales, but not much more than that. And now I know a lot more. So
you'll be giving your final PhD seminar soon, will
you? Yeah, later, November 4th, back in Copenhagen.
If you've got any questions, cool ocean facts or stories to share, get in touch with us on social media or email. You can find all the details on the show notes, and we'd love to hear from you. If you've enjoyed this episode, follow Ocean Pod wherever you listen and leave us a review. It really helps other ocean lovers find us.
Music written and performed by Seamus Nicholas. Graphic design by Rhiannon Van Eck. This podcast is produced by us, Nina and Bronwyn, supported by the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide.